right, you're listening to Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we built our entire episode around the cover story for our March issue called Taco Nation. It's got recipes, essays, graphics, and more, all celebrating tacos. Up first is Rick Andrew Martinez, who developed a bunch of new recipes for the package. He walks us through two of them, his duck carnitas tacos and his pork volcanes tacos. Plus, he tells us about his foolproof formula for infinite kinds of salsas, from chopped and raw to charred and pureed. Then, associate editor Hillary Cadigan, who edited the package, sits down with Steven Alvarez, professor of taco literacy at St. John's University in Queens. One note on this segment, Alvarez misidentified the name of a particular taco spot he mentions, the one with the good chilorio. It's actually called Mi Dulce Mexico. Finally, the writer Manuel Gonzalez reads his essay, Tacos Are My Resistance. There is so much amazing stuff in this package. I urge you to go check it out. The recipes are all on bonappetit.com right now. The rest of the stories will go up tomorrow, and the issue is on stands. All right, enjoy the show. Is that a new apron you have on there, Rick?
It is. My Mexico City apron.
What does a Mexico City apron entail exactly?
Usually color. So this is my oxblood leather apron, which I really like a lot.
Where did you get it?
There's a shop called 180 in Condesa. And they just have like really cool clothes, a lot of t-shirts, really cool designs. And I saw this apron hanging in the window. I was like, I need that.
For those people who have not been to Mexico City, which is a city I love, can you explain Condesa as a neighborhood?
It's really beautiful. It's one of the hearts of the city. It has a very distinct style of architecture. It's kind of parts of Condesa are mid-century. There are a lot of really cool boutique shops, a lot of designers, a lot of artists, a lot of really cool new restaurants are opening up in that area. But there are a lot of neighborhoods in Mexico City that are kind of happening right now. Roma is really fun, San Rafael, Juarez.
Yeah, Condesa struck me as a lot of trees and parks and everything.
I think people are always surprised when they go to Mexico City. They expect it to be a little more urban. And the thing that's really great about Mexico City is that it's very tropical. And so there are huge, huge trees and big parks that are almost like you can't see through them. It's like a tropical rainforest in some cases.
Yeah, I think people sometimes expect more, a little bit more like L.A. where there's just that concrete sprawl.
Right.
But it feels so much more fertile and verdant as a city with all these little neighborhoods. And I don't know, if you haven't been to Mexico City, I highly recommend it.
You definitely need to go.
All right, today we have a big taco cover story in the March issue by Rick Martinez, as well as several other contributors. There's a lot about sort of the history of the taco and places to get them. I want to focus today a little bit more on how the tacos that you make and what you love about them and how you do it. I want to start with the cover taco.
Okay.
The duck carnitas with radish escabeche.
You know, carnitas are my favorite taco, and it's normally pork, and I love them so much. It's like, it's a textural thing. It's a flavor thing. If properly cooked, they should be really crispy on the outside and tender and soft on the inside. And you know, and I feel like people are accustomed to carnitas, and you know, we have recipes on BA.com.
So yeah, well, let's start there in terms of like classic carnitas. And I'm with you. Like, I can't resist carnitas when I see it. What is the most classic way to make it, and what does that entail?
I mean, classic depends on where you are. Like in parts of Mexico, you know, the pork is braised until all of the fat melts, and then eventually the liquid evaporates and the pork is fried in its own fat. And so that's what gives you the soft texture on the inside, but then you get like the crispy bits on the outside.
So as it's braising, it's getting soft and breaking down the collagen and all that, and then it ends up simmering in its own fat, and that gets that crispy exterior.
Right. So in the state of Michoacán, which is in the central part of Mexico, there are these huge copper vats, and they will literally put, like, you know, almost a whole pig in these pots, and they're just slow simmered all day until the fat renders. And depending on what town you're in, there are some towns like Quiroga, which they put oranges and cinnamon and herbs, and so you get a much more sort of flavorful and herbaceous, almost fruity style of carnitas. Then you have other cities or towns like Comitán that are like, no, it's salt, pepper, lard. That's it.
I've been to those places. You're like, man, that is porky.
Yeah, yeah. And I think both styles are equally good, you know, because also you're going to put salsas on it. There are other things that are going to go on it. And if you've got really great quality pork, you know, it's really nice to taste the pork.
So when you go to a classic carnitas place in Mexico and they've got the big cauldron there simmering away, when people order, do they tend to request certain cuts or parts?
Yes. So you can get a little bit of everything. So what happens is they will literally just pull the pork out of the pot and put it on a board and then just chop it up for you. And in a lot of places we'll save the ear whole, and then people will request pieces of the ear. People will request pieces of the cheek and the snout. There's some offal in there as well, so you can get that as a cut. And then there's the sort of like, it's kind of like the brisket. There's the sort of drier end, and then there's the more moist end. You can request those as well, or just give me a little bit of everything. Just chop it all up and put it in a taco.
Dealer's choice. Okay, so taking that sort of philosophy and approach to carnitas, how do you then apply that to this duck carnitas recipe that you created for the magazine?
I wanted to change it up. I think the really amazing thing to me about tacos in the United States right now is that there are a lot of really amazing things happening. A lot of Mexican Americans and a lot of immigrants are coming into this country, and they're taking their traditional methods and techniques from wherever they came from in Mexico, but they're using local ingredients, or they're using things that are more accessible to them in whatever location they're in. And what's happening is you're getting this really, really cool food. It's the food that they love, but it's, you know, it's got an American twist on it. And that's kind of what my approach was with all of these. You know, I love carnitas, pork carnitas, but I wanted to, you know, to change it up a little bit.
And you can already find Rick's double pork carnitas recipe on bonappetit.com. Just Google double pork carnitas, and that's with the pork shoulder and pork belly.
And
it's ridiculously good.
And also, like, pretty easy. It's like five ingredients. And that was the style that I was going for. I was like, I just want to taste the really good pork and have a really great texture.
So walk me through this recipe. What do you start with?
Oh, so this is basically a play off of a duck confit. So, you know, I think a lot of people know duck confit, and I love duck. And I thought it would be kind of fun to play kind of riff off of that. And I had originally thought, you know, confiting the duck legs in duck fat, but it's expensive. And honestly, like, I also like the idea of the duck and the pork coming together. So I actually just use lard. Lard is pretty cheap. So you spend the money on the duck legs. I threw in some cinnamon and some chili de árbol and some orange and some aromatics. And you melt the pork fat, put that over the salted cured duck legs, and that just slow roasts in the oven until it falls off the bone.
Yeah.
So you've got the texture, and then of course you need chicharrones for a carnita taco, and so you've got this amazing duck skin that's been, you know, slow braising in lard, and so you just take that off and give it a little pan fry and a little bit of the lard until it's really crispy. It's so good. This was my favorite taco of the batch.
It made the cover. And like I said, you put some orange in there. There's some cloves, and you sort of cinnamon stick. You infuse it with those flavorings. When you have meat that is like that rich and crispy and unctuous, you then want to balance it with something a little acidic, perhaps. So what'd you do there?
One of the things that I feel like a lot of people think of automatically is, you know, the cilantro and the onion, which obviously exists in taquerias both in Mexico and here. But radishes are used a lot. And the great thing about radishes is they cut through a lot of, like, the rich fillings. They give you a little bit of bite. They pair well with chilies. They take acid really well. So I wanted to play off of that. Also, they're pretty. So I kind of wanted to make a little radish escabeche. So you've got, like, the lime juice. I've got Fresno peppers because they're beautiful. And they're a little bit more fruity than a jalapeno. But you still got, like, that really nice heat, and I think they pair well with the duck and all of the other aromatics that are in there.
You throw a curveball I consider it a curve. Instead of cilantro, you're going with tarragon and fresh mint as an herb sort of addition. Talk to me about that.
Well, again, I feel like most people just, you know, they have this association that cilantro is Mexican food. And the reality is that, you know, in Mexico, there are so many different kinds of herbs. And, you know, I've been driving around to, you know, markets and all over southern and central Mexico, and I'm shocked, continually shocked at all of these different herbs that are used. And a lot of them, unfortunately, are not available here. But the tarragon and the mint, that kind of that flavor profile, the anise flavor of the tarragon and the kind of spiciness of the mint exist in a lot of the herbs that are used down there. And so I wanted to mimic that kind of flavor profile. And so that was one of the reasons why I used it.
I think what also might surprise some folks who think of authentic tacos is that you paired the duck carnitas not with the corn tortilla, but a flour tortilla.
Yeah.
And I know you, when in the piece, when you're talking about good, real tacos, it all starts with the tortilla.
Yeah.
So talk to me about flour tortillas and where we're at right now.
So, you know, I grew up in Texas, and my grandmother and my mother made flour tortillas. So that was at a time where, you know, you couldn't buy flour tortillas at the grocery store.
Or not good ones, at least.
Not, I mean, actually, in the 70s and early 80s, there were just not any available.
Wow, okay.
Unfortunately, then you started finding them, and then my mother stopped making them, except for special occasions, which sucked. A fresh homemade flour tortilla is amazing. It's got more substance. It's got more texture than what you normally find at a grocery store or store-bought tortilla. It's a little thicker. And to be honest, I didn't like corn tortillas growing up because the only corn tortillas I had were the store-bought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it was my mom's homemade flour or the store-bought packaged corn. So that, to me, is what home is. That, you know, all of our tacos, the breakfast tacos, taco night was always on a flour tortilla. The only time that we had corn was usually on tostada night. And my mom would make chalupas and fry the corn tortillas, and then she'd layer them with like beans and chorizo and cheese. And it wasn't until I started going to Mexico that, you know, I was like, oh, this is what a corn tortilla is. When you actually have a corn tortilla made from fresh nixtamalized corn, different colors, different grinds, you can actually taste the nuttiness and the toastiness of the corn. I was like, this is not anything like I've had. And, you know, and we made the comparison in this piece about, you know, it's like eating sandwiches on, you know, sliced white bread.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden you're introduced to brioche and boules and sourdoughs and multigrains. And it's like, oh my God,
what have I been missing? Yeah.
Exactly.
And I think what's notable right now in the States, first with the flour tortillas, is that there are so many good, like just delicious flour tortillas now available. We've mentioned the ones by the Kansas City brand, Caramelo, which will ship them to you. They do ones with duck fat or avocado oil. Mm-hmm. Here in the New York area, you have Vista Hermosa is a great brand. Talk about the ones at Sonora Town, the restaurant in L.A. But you get a good flour tortilla. They're translucent, almost transparent. They're made with so much rich, delicious fat, pressed together. They get the little brown spots as they're on the griddle. And it's just like, it's almost like when you go to a Chinese restaurant and get Peking duck and get the little pancakes. You're like,
right.
Oh my God, this is amazing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. Compared to like those flour ones that I think a lot of us grew up with at the supermarket, they're basically what you get when you get like a wrap at the cafeteria.
Well,
and they're just,
they're horrible.
They're depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you get the real thing and you're like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah. And a lot of people that have not had good tortillas just, you know, a lot of my friends have said to me, the tortilla is just the device to like get the food in your mouth. And then when you actually taste a real tortilla, you know, a flour made with like an animal fat or a corn tortilla made with like fresh corn, it actually has a flavor that complements the filling. And it's incredible. It changes the whole taco.
Yeah. And we mentioned in this article that there are a lot of chefs now that are sourcing heirloom corn, grinding it themselves, making their own masa that they can then make tortillas from. And, you know, we talked about the ones, where we said corn tortillas you should buy in bulk. Three Sisters Nixtamal in Portland, Oregon, Hawaii Masa in Honolulu, Kernel of Truth Organics in L.A., Yoli Tortilleria in Kansas City, and Manos de Maize in D.C., that, yeah, you Google them, look it up, see what's in your area. Can you get you can go to Caramelo to get the flour ones. You can, if Vista Hermosa ships you, if you're in the tri-state area, they're so worth searching out. It's like, you know, if you grew up eating pizza, like the difference when you get a pizza with a really good crust, mm-hmm. and like real flours, and it's just like, oh, like you don't need all this random toppings on.
Right.
Because the base itself is so something you want to focus on. Let me ask you this. If I'm in Mexico City, mm-hmm. taquerias I should hit up when I'm there.
Okay. Los Cocuyos. I have to go there almost every time I go down. It's a complete little hole in the wall. It's probably about the size of this table. There is a giant pot in the very front of this taco stand, and in it is lard and then every cut of meat that they offer. And every morning they heat up the lard, they put in the longaniza, the beef, the pork, all the offal, and everything just simmers in that same fat. And then around midday, everything is nice and soft. They'll pull out, you know, the piece that you order, they'll cut it up for you. They lightly dip the tortillas in the fat, put it on the comal, like kind of fry it up a little bit. After they cut your meat, they throw that on the comal, get a little crispy edge on that, put a little more fat on it. It's incredible.
Seems like fat is the key word here.
Fat is a big part of this, you know, for taquerias. But, you know, it carries all the flavor. And then you've got this, you know, this amazing pork fat that has all the flavors of all the different things that have been cooking in it. And so, you know.
When you're hitting up taquerias in Mexico City or elsewhere in Mexico, what's your drink of choice usually?
I love aguas. I mean, Jamaica is pretty common, and I like it a lot. Horchata is pretty common. So the Jamaica is the hibiscus flower drink, and so it's just hibiscus flower, water, and sugar. The horchata is rice, usually cinnamon or Mexican cinnamon, which is canela, sugar, sometimes a milk product. But, you know, when you're down there, the fruit is so amazing. And so what the aguas are is basically just fruit and water. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's a pineapple called piña de miel. It's a little bitty pineapple. Miel is honey or syrup. And it is so incredibly sweet. And they just cut it up, put it in a blender with some water, and blend it up.
That's
and
all
so
you
it's
need.
Like
yeah.
frothy pineapple water.
Yeah, when you go to I obviously have not traveled Mexico as much as you have, but just going to the markets and like the bounty of fresh, ripe fruit is stunning.
Incredible. Yeah. And even in the middle of winter, I mean, you know.
Well, in the middle of winter, it's 75 degrees in Mexico City.
Right. And there's still strawberry stands and papaya and pineapple.
Let's talk about another. You did four recipes. We're going to talk about two of them in this package. You want to talk about the volcanes?
Volcan. So this is something that was inspired actually by another taqueria in Mexico City. So there's a place called El Rey de Ahogada, and they have an incredible volcán al pastor. So al pastor is very popular in Mexico City in particular. It's pork that's put on a trompo. The trompo is a cooking method that was brought by the Lebanese and the Iraqis and that migrated into Mexico. It's a descendant of shawarma, actually.
Yeah, so shawarma, gyros, souvlaki, it's kind of like layered on a spit.
Right, and so when it got into Mexico, the meat was changed out to pork, and then the spices were changed into dried chilies, but the cooking method stayed the same. So the volcanes are also called vampiros. So basically it's a corn tortilla that's toasted on a griddle or comal until the edges kind of curl up. And depending on what part of Mexico you're in, they either resemble a volcano, which is a volcan, or in northern Mexico where there are a lot of bats, they resemble a bat wing of a vampire bat.
And so that's kind of a cooler name. Right?
Yeah, I think so. So in northern Mexico, they're called vampiros. But in any case,
do the tortillas get crispy or
they're completely crispy?
Okay.
So that it's toasted. So they have a very toasted, nutty corn flavor, and they're completely crispy. So you basically it's a slow toast on a low heat until all the water's evaporated, and that's why they kind of pucker up and curl. And then the ones that I had at El Rey were the al pastor with a little bit of queso, either queso Oaxaco, quesillo, or queso fresco, and some salsa verde.
And that's basically a very subtle, fresh white cheese.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a farmer's cheese or kind of like a cross between a Mott's and a Jack. But they're incredible. Like, they're absolutely delicious because you get the flavor of the toasted corn plus the crunch gives you that texture that you don't get in a regular taco.
Okay, so let's just, assuming if you don't have like a spit at home, are we making the meat for this
one? Well, that's why I wanted to make this because, you know, I'm not in Mexico all the time. And so, you know, and if you're craving al pastor, it's difficult for a lot of people to find it. And even taquerias around New York or whatever city, you know, you are in America don't always have trompos. So this is a much easier version. So we are lightly freezing pork shoulder, and we are slicing it really thin, marinating.
And the freezing is just so to make it easier to slice.
Right. We've done this technique a couple of times for cheesesteak sandwiches and bulgogi, and I really like this technique a lot. So it mimics a deli slicer. So you basically, you know, you put your cut of meat in the freezer for about an hour until it gets, you know, really stiff.
We call for 1 2-pound piece of skinless, boneless pork shoulder, Boston butt.
Yeah. Pork shoulder has a lot of flavor. It has a lot of marbling and fat. It can either be really quickly pan-fried, which is what I did here, or you can do like long, slow braises. And it's also pretty economical. So you can buy a nice piece, freeze it, do little really thin shaved slices, make a quick marinade with some guajillo and some dried chilies, a little bit of achiote paste if you can find it, which is very, you know, that's kind of the calling card of an al pastor is the achiote. And then you just pan fry it.
And the orange juice and lime juice also.
And so once that marinades, then you just throw it in a nonstick skillet, give it a little pan fry for a couple of minutes on each side, and you've got your al pastor.
As you mentioned, like bulgogi, it's sliced thinly enough it's a high heat, pretty quick. You get a little crispy on the edges, but still tender in the middle.
Yeah. I also didn't want to have anybody have to sit at a skillet and you know, babysit the tortillas. So you put them on a sheet tray in the oven, let them go for like, I think, 10, 15 minutes. They dehydrate, they crisp up, they pucker, and now you've got your volcanes.
Yeah. So typically, most tacos, or if you go to a taqueria, you're often a good one. You've got your choice of salsas often.
Yeah.
For the home cook, give me some basic salsa advice, what to do, what not to do.
You know, I think people get really scared about getting it right. And the reality is that, you know, you probably have everything you need for a good salsa already in your house or your pantry. I think my favorite kind of salsa, and a lot of taquerias do this, they make blender salsas. So you need some kind of a base, which typically is either a tomato or a tomatillo. But you can also use fruit bases, which I actually like a lot because, you know, they add a little bit of sweetness. You can also get like underripe mangoes, which actually is a lot easier here, or pineapple. You just cut that up and that becomes your base in the blender salsa. I listed out some non-negotiables. I think in order to get that salsa flavor, you need a little bit of heat from an onion, a garlic, and then obviously a chili.
That's a question. So, yeah, you say choose your heat, and you have like jalapeno, serrano, habanero, all which are very accessible in the States, as well as some other ones, Fresno, Thai, Cascabel, etc. The non-negotiables, how prevalent is garlic in Mexico and salsas? Is garlic kind of like a non-negotiable, or is that a Rick Martinez thing?
That's more a me thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a little more common in Texas and maybe some of the northern states. Generally, like the further in you go, it's just going to be white onion. White onion is sort of the onion of choice for a lot of the salsas. But a lot of the blender salsas throw in a clove of garlic in there as well. And I just feel like the garlic and the onion kind of balance each other out because you're not putting that much. You're probably putting like, you know, a quarter of an onion in there.
And then some herbs. You said whether cilantro, mint, parsley, tarragon, basil. We kind of do it as a formula in the magazine. You said, you know, pick a fruit or vegetable or both. I mean, and also, tomatoes are fruit, as they always remind us. Tomatillo has that acid, the sweetness. You get your chili, you have some herbs, you have your onion, garlic, lime juice, salt. Blend it. You say give some options then. You say you can blend it, or if you have a bit more time, chop everything into cute little cubes for a pico de gallo vibe. So that's like a hand-chopped version.
Yeah, yeah.
And then talk about the more charred salsas.
I love making salsas, you know, charring things on the grill. So like in the summertime, when I have access to a grill, I'm out there, I'm like just grilling everything. But also, it's a really great way to coax flavor out of season produce.
Yeah.
So like yesterday, I had a green pineapple that essentially was hard as a rock and didn't have any flavor and didn't want to light the grill. So I actually just put the pineapple slices directly on the grate of a gas stove And so you get like the quick charring. It softened it up, and remarkably, it actually started to taste like a pineapple again.
It probably brought out the sugars.
It brought out the sugar. Yeah. So you get the caramel, you get a little bit of char. It's soft, and obviously it was underripe, so it wasn't super sweet, but that's actually kind of what you want for a salsa. You want a little hint of sweetness, but not like something that's...
Yeah, I've done that before with a friend, Luis, who's from Mexico City originally, and just you want to have a salsa with your tacos. It's not peak season on the East Coast with tomatoes. And there's nothing worse than trying to make a pico de gallo with underripe tomatoes. It's just, it's sad.
But it's very sad.
You can take some of those same tomatoes, Roma-style tomatoes, and put them in a cast iron skillet and char them, get the outsides a little black, and it introduces a sort of a depth of flavor that is not there prior, and then throw everything in the blender.
Exactly.
And you'd also char the onion a little bit and maybe the chili, or what would you do?
I usually try and stick with, you know, maybe one or two charred things and one or two raw things.
Okay, yeah.
Just so that you have a contrast of fresh and
so it's not too smoky.
Right, because at a certain point, everything is just gets one note. Like, you're going to taste is char.
I've made that mistake before. Most recently, yes. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Then I think what's fun about this package that you worked on, not only the recipes, the point of view, but we have got a lot of great essays from Mexican Americans about the importance of tacos in their life and where to get them, sort of kind of putting them into cultural context. But before we go, you got a couple minutes, Rick. Pitch us on the book you're working on right now.
I'm so excited about this. Basically, I feel like a lot of people think of Mexican food as being tacos and burritos and nachos. And the country is so big, and there's so much coastline, and there's so much, you know, agriculture happening in Mexico. And so what I've done is I bought a car in Mexico City, and I'm literally driving to every state in Mexico, all 31 states, and just exploring the food and the culture and the markets. And so the book is going to be a regional Mexican cookbook that highlights the foods of each different region, but in a much easier and approachable way. Like, I don't want anybody to have to buy special equipment. I don't want you to have to like source, you know, 30 ingredients from Amazon or specialty food stores. So it's going to be the American grocery store version of these dishes, because I'd also like you to just buy a ticket and actually go to Mexico and eat the mole.
Couple questions. There. How many miles do you expect to put on the car by the time you're all done?
So I am officially halfway done. I've hit 16 states, 69 cities, and 11,000 kilometers. So I will probably put another 11,000 on. So that all total in miles will be about probably 12,000 to 15,000 miles.
Okay, that's manageable. We know there'll be recipes in the book. How much will the book also sort of be a travel guide in terms of like where to visit or maybe where to stay, those sort of things about each destination?
Each chapter will open up with, you know, a photo essay and an essay about the region itself. Like, why is the food this way? What are the people like? What is the geography like? And I'm going to highlight like the places that I really love that I think that, you know, people should be visiting and trying the food.
And so, if there's a particular taqueria or restaurant, make sure you go here when visiting.
Exactly. Yeah.
What is your Instagram?
It is Rick_Andrew_Martinez.
I would highly recommend to the listener to start following Rick. Sort of traveling along with you during this journey is so cool. Not only seeing the food, of which you always take amazing, beautifully, naturally lit photos of, but the ingredients and the restaurants and the markets and the architecture. So much country, so many different vibes and personalities and cultures within that giant country that I think sometimes Americans think of just, oh, Mexican food.
Right.
Which is such a limited way to think of it.
And even me, like, you know, I've been to Mexico quite a bit, but like there are so many things, like every day is just like some new thing that I didn't know of before. And what's really cool about this book is basically all of the things that I loved eating on this journey are going to be in the book.
That's what I love about the Instagram follow, is that you can sense your enthusiasm as you sort of experience and learn about these new things as you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you can check out Rick's recipes and article in the March issue of Bon Appetit. Thanks so much, Rick.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Hillary Cadigan, Associate Editor at Bon Appetit, and I am here with Stephen Alvarez, who teaches a class called Taco Literacy at St. John's University in Queens. He is colloquially known as the Taco Professor, so we've got a real expert in here today. Stephen, I guess my first question is, how does one become a professor of taco literacy?
I guess I ask myself that question all the time, really. And, you know, it's more of like a career trajectory that brought me here. My research was always about Mexican people. I'm Mexican-American by background. And it just so happened that when I was, of course, studying about Mexican folks and migration and stories, that food was always there. And I think over time it merged that food became a way for me to think about language, family, care, migration, all bound together, really to think about the resilience of Mexican communities. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of food was always the undercurrent, but then it sort of exploded and I realized through food I could reach a lot more people to get my message out in terms of humanizing Mexican immigrants. So it was a natural trajectory. It just kind of happened that way. And, you know, to be the taco professor, I mean, that works for me, too.
Yeah, it's a pretty good title. You know, who taught you? Like, was there legions of taco professors that came before you? Or are you kind of the first? Or
I really have to say, it all begins with my family.
Okay.
I mean, it begins with the knowledge passed down from my family's both sides, my parents and my grandparents, and didn't really appreciate it at the time. It's kind of the thing where growing up, I think I was ashamed of our food, turning more towards like the chicken McNuggets and yummy stuff that, you know, stuff that was fast food and that kind of appeal. And to really reflect on it, though, once I realized later on in grad school, I met Gustavo Arellano, another taco maestro.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized there was a whole body of research into Mexican food, something that I had hardly really thought that folks would consider a place of academic study. So it really opened up my eyes. And then I realized there was just so much material. So there's a lot of great books about tacos. There's Taco USA, Planet Taco, Tacopedia, books about tortillas. So it really just kind of fit into place. And so I think tapping into the different kind of research out there really broadened my perspective for sure.
Okay, cool. So walk me through the first day of a taco literacy class.
I mean, of course, we have to introduce the syllabus and then
right.
We all have to just kind of sit and together and say, hey, we're in a class about tacos. And then we just have to get that out of the way.
Do you serve tacos at this class?
The first day, I actually bring in tamarindo, tamarind.
Ooh.
And also candy tamarind. So they can see what the raw product looks like, but also what the finished product looks like. And then they can practice their Instagram and taking pictures, like, you know, the same way they would do a selfie like 12 different times to get their dimple. Make sure you get the tamarind dimple and everything right. So anyway,
these are the skills of 2020.
You need to know
these
things,
exactly.
Right? But anyway, it's also a way for them to do a little bit of research about tamarind and how it's migrated across the world in different cuisines and different kind of strands of the plant that have emerged over time.
Cool.
And it really, I mean, even looking into the etymology of the word, which comes from Arabic, it gives a lot of idea how that moved around because the language and the food are connected together. So even though at the very beginning there's some levity about, hey, we're in taco class, you know what you're getting yourself into, and then really moving into how this can be critical. So I try to balance it with the fun.
Mm-hmm.
I try to keep them amused,
mm-hmm.
Very hard. And then also, you know, bringing in food to talk about the food and really kind of get hands-on with it, but also think about how they're trying to write about the food, because it really is a writing class.
Okay, cool. What is the lesson that you're, like, most excited to teach every year?
I mean, I have a lot of fun where I take students on a taco tour of Queens.
Oh, amazing.
And we go to a few different places and we try some of the lesser known tacos that people don't really know. I mean, people know about them, but they're more popular here in New York. So tacos árabes, tacos placeros. Tacos árabes are sort of the grandfather of what we understand as tacos al pastor.
Mm.
And this was more, I mean, the easiest way to describe it was this is the kind of shawarma style meat that was brought from Lebanese and Iraqi immigrants to Mexico. And well, sort of the gyro and shawarma style later on was adapted to pork. And that then became, because it was on a pita bread, was a thick tortilla, like a flour tortilla.
Yeah.
So for the colloquially, Mexicans recognize that those as Arab tacos for the immigrants. And then later on, they adapted them well. And that's kind of where the genesis of the what we understand today as tacos al pastor or shepherd style tacos. So the Mediterranean influence. So even just that, for example, when speaking with the students, so find that kind of trajectory in the movement while we're walking on the street in Queens and somebody is carving the trompo, mm-hmm. and we can actually see where that's coming from. And then the students, by this time, because it's usually the end of the semester treat, they have this kind of very critical vocabulary to speak about corn, the production of corn, nixtamal. They can speak about also aspects of trade and trade inequality. So it's a lot more than just tacos, but tacos is the entry point. And I think tacos generally are the entry point for a lot of people when it comes to Mexican food.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that kind of brings us, so a lot of what you're teaching, I mean, we've got the writing aspect, but you're kind of taking them through, you know, the history of tacos. Where do you start? For our taco package in the magazine, you wrote our timeline, the mm-hmm. tacos in the USA. So that was specifically about taco moments here in the States. But I feel like in order to even jump into that timeline, we need to go back to like, okay, where did tacos come from in the first place?
It's like you're asking me about great moments in taco history.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a lot. Yeah, it's hard to limit to just four.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the larger, I guess, Mesoamerican ancient history where really it's the, I don't know, I guess you say the genius and the invention of the flatbread of the corn tortilla. And anything that goes inside the corn tortilla then in some way becomes a taco. But really it was just considered how you eat, almost like another utensil. But really becomes popular, I guess you would say, in the first wave in the late 19th century in Mexico where, so the legend goes, miners from Pachuca found their way to Mexico City and they brought along with them a cuisine they were used to. Now, one of the legends is that the origin of the word taco is for a stick of dynamite. Where we understand is the taquito today. So there is that sort of legend of people coming from rural areas and working areas to Mexico City, and then the food becomes sort of popularized street food, where we see things like tacos en canasta, tacos in box, very mobile food, but also working class people.
Right.
Well, later on, you know, once folks start arriving to the United States around Mexican Revolution especially, you see sort of, I guess, the second wave. Mm-hmm. And that's when Mexican food really starts entering the United States in larger numbers outside of California and Texas historically. Okay. And at that time, you start to see tacos emerging in different places and especially becoming popular in places like California, all throughout and around the border area. But also handfuls of folks making their way up to Chicago, too.
Right.
And that second wave is still Mexican food hasn't quite made its way into the American palate. What was more popular at the time were tamales and chili, or we understand chili con carne. Mm-hmm. Those were the first mainstream foods.
Right.
Around 1950s is when we had some fast time innovation, post-World War War American bootstraps mentality of like, the sit-down restaurant, the inventions of the U-fryer. So we really see the emergence of fast food culture emerging with Mexican food.
Can you explain what the U-fryer is?
So this is what we understand today to get the hard-shell taco.
Ah,
Because it doesn't exist always like that
the
in a natural form.
Off-the-line hard-shell
yeah,
taco.
Yeah. No, when we scrape it off the corn, it doesn't come off hard-shell. There's a whole process. So it's the whole tortilla. And then they had to find some people with all kinds of mentality. And Juvencio Maldonado here in New York City was the first one who designed this U-contraption for frying the same way like a French fryer. Operation would work because too many people were burning their hands.
Right.
You would hurt yourself, of course. It's
like
dangerous.
That scene in Arrested Development. Have you ever seen that where they like have the little corn ball machine or whatever?
Yeah.
And, like, they burn their hands every time.
But you know, there were some people though that who were experts at this who were able to just, I guess they have developed callus on their fingers or anything, but in order to be able to produce 10, 20, 30 per order, there had to be a faster way to do this.
Yeah.
So credit that American innovation, I guess, but also some people would argue appropriation. Mm-hmm. So the third wave, though, you start to see happening around, well, post-1970s, where more Mexicans from Mexico begin to arrive up into the 80s and then well into the 90s. And here you can start to see more regional varieties of Mexican food, somewhat usurping that idea of the standard taco, which is the Taco Bell kind of taco.
Right. So what was bringing them to the U.S. during that time? Was there
There was a larger geopolitical and social issues, but probably the largest one was the Mexican peso crisis in the 90s, and also arguably the North American Free Trade Agreement, which destabilized a lot of land farmers or farmers who had small plots of land, subsistence farmers, and who could no longer compete with the corn that was being dumped from the United States. So it was cheaper for them to buy corn and grow their own corn in the birthplace of corn,
right.
Mexico. So that wave brought different people first from rural areas of Mexico to Mexico City, and that's when Mexico City had tremendous growth. And a lot of those folks ended up coming to places like New York, a lot of folks from the state of Puebla here in Puebla, York. So, you know, and I guess you would say maybe the fourth wave might be where we are now and kind of into the present. And we're starting to see this sort of ubiquitous popularity of Mexican food and gourmet food and even gourmet tacos and the return to heirloom tortillas. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, there might be in the future we might say going on because I think if we're breaking this down in four, and the Aztecs would say that's the fourth sun, and maybe we're looking forward to the fifth sun where there will be a complete taco revolution and the world will realize that peace happens in a tortilla.
Yes, I love that. You heard it here first.
That's right.
So yeah, and that's, you know, this package that we've been working on where it was kind of like suddenly, I mean, not suddenly, because obviously we're hearing about the whole trajectory of how this happened, but it feels like now in the U.S., it's like we know, well, we've always known that, you know, Mexico has its own food regions. It's like you're going to find totally different food in the north than you're going to find in the south. And now it almost feels like we have our own like taco regions here in the U.S. as well, which I think is part of what makes it so interesting to eat tacos right now. Like, you know, I was going to Baltimore this weekend and there's like these amazing tacos that you told me about there. And I was doing some research and I was like, huh, this is like one of the fastest growing Mexican populations that's there. And so can you tell me a bit about like what is sort of creating these different pockets?
Yeah, well, first it sounds like you're already practicing your taco literacy. You're doing the research and when you're learning about the food, you're learning about the history, you're learning about the culture, and most importantly, you're learning about the people.
Yeah.
And I think that happens with all foods. They're hard to disassociate because as soon as you decontextualize the food, you remove the human element.
Mm-hmm.
So with this, though, I mean, one way to think about this, of course, you're exactly right. There's all the regional varieties of Mexican food in Mexico. And that tells you one thing about the migration patterns of folks who come from those regions and where they settle in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So in New York, we're able to find tamales that are wrapped in banana leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So one indication is that, well, these are folks probably either from Veracruz or maybe they're from Oaxaca. But folks from Oaxaca migrate to specific areas. And a lot of the ways, at least sociologists look at this, is where there's a wave of migrants who first settled themselves, and they sort of reach out to members of their family or their social networks.
Mm.
So you'll find very easily here in New York people that come from the entire same hometown. And you'll see sometimes restaurants called Cuatzinco, for example, where people come from that small town. They've formed these sort of networks of people who sometimes their first entryway in the United States, that might be their first job before they move on, and sometimes open up their own restaurant as well. So to really break it down, once you've realized that the regional varieties are in your town, it also tells you about where people have migrated from.
Right.
And in case of New York, it's mostly folks from the region called the Mixtec, or the Mixteca.
Mm-hmm.
So those three states of Oaxaca, Guerrero, and Puebla is where we find a lot of really beautiful indigenous cuisine that has found its way to New York, which is also another element of Mexican food, the amount of indigeneity and also the sometimes the resistance to indigeneity in that history.
What does that mean? What do you mean by resistance?
The best way to think about this is like the eternal war between flour tortillas and corn tortillas.
Yeah. Where do you stand on the
side? As if you can't have both.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Like, why can't I have both?
So you're both guys.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, but I have to be honest, my preference, because I grew up in southern Arizona and my mom is from Sonora, is I grew up with flour tortillas.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, it's not so much because I love the flavor, but it's more like the feeling and the memory that I savor. But
how do you make your flour tortillas? What do you use as the fat?
Oh, well, you see, here's the trick.
Okay.
I mean, I love manteca, but also we grew up with Crisco.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I'll do both. But I have to be honest, when I have a manteca tortilla, I can tell.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But the story, though, about the corn and the flour is a way we can think about that. When the Spaniards arrived, when they conquered the indigenous people, when you conquer people, you will conquer their language, you conquer their history, and you try to conquer their food.
Mm.
And because you really want them to hopefully assimilate, but also be purchasers in the larger market you are trying to expand, in this case, wheat.
Huh.
So the idea for them, at least for the Spaniards and their ideology, is that the reason why we conquered you is because you're food. If you eat like us, you'll be like us. So this also meant that, for example, it didn't always work the case. They tried to eradicate corn, but it was never going to go away.
Right.
We were people of the corn in Mexico, and corn was worshipped, and corn was revered, and corn grew along with people, and it built large societies. So even though there were Spaniards who would say they would eat their, you know, flour tortillas at night when, you know, they had a few maybe tequilas, they were going out for their tacos too.
Yeah, what we really want.
Of course. They were like everybody else, because you can't deny how yummy a delicious taco is when it's warm.
Yeah.
There's no way.
There's nothing like it, truly. I've been eating tacos constantly the entire time I've been working on this package, and I'm not even remotely sick of them. I think this is something I could literally eat every day.
It's living the dream.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I got to ask you, we kind of went through the 50s period of where tacos got sort of Americanized here in the U.S. And as you wrote in the timeline, there were some perhaps interesting, shall we say, moments where, you know, there was a taco TV dinner that came with canned tortillas, which I think your comment on that was no comment.
I mean, what could you say?
Have you ever tried a canned tortilla?
I've only heard legends about them. I've also heard legends of canned bread, which I've never
seen.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have canned tamales, and
It
wasn't one of my finer moments, but I was also in college, so that's the excuse I gave.
Yeah.
You know, I think the way you could think about this, and I think Gustavo Arellano does a really great job in Taco USA, it's a kind of recurring pattern where Mexican food somehow gets interpreted by another audience who believes that they can make it better, more efficient, and more marketable.
Mm-hmm.
And not always more delicious,
right.
But actually sometimes adapted to their needs, what are usually market-centered needs.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 50s, where there was a burgeoning, I think it, the way I like to think of this is like 1950s Silicon Valley was the fast food startup, and it was Southern California. McDonald's kind of started it all, and people were making quick money. But it was also, there was a lot of theft from competitors. But the big story, I think, probably goes back to Taco Bell.
Yeah, we have to talk about Taco Bell.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And, you know, that we have a couple classes where we talk about Taco Bell in my class.
You got to have a few. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's conflicted, though, because, of course, a lot of folks have their introduction to Mexican food through Taco Bell.
Right.
Of course. And I respect. And also, even the hard shell taco, hey, it's authentic. It exists. Mm-hmm. It's a real thing.
Right.
It's an American invention.
Right. Invented by Mexican Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, the Taco Dorado goes way back, at any rate. So Glenn Bell was trying his hand at a few different startup restaurants, not doing so well, doing okay. And he was having a hard time at a go selling some burgers and things. And he noticed there was this Mexican restaurant across the way from where he was working, one of his restaurants called the Meatla Cafe, still standing.
Yeah.
Cesar Chavez used to have meetings there. At any rate, he saw the long lines outside the building, and he decided, I got to go see what's going on. And they were selling tacos dorados that were, of course, hand-fried with a toothpick. So a lot of you know, time going into these, you know, fast food, really heavy in the grease.
So the toothpick was like holding it together?
Yeah, the toothpick was holding it together before using a U-fryer. It's also the same technique my mother would use, too, I remember. So you have to remember those toothpicks are in there, though, because sometimes you forget.
Yeah, that's the technique you use to photograph our tacos.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. All right, keeping it old school. Yeah. Well, Bell was trying these tacos, and he saw there was long lines all the time, so he started like sort of observing them, observing or maybe spying, and trying to figure out the recipe and going back to his own place and trying to perfect this recipe, which is already ostensibly perfect, I guess. But at any rate, the movement was, how can I take these and make them more marketable, mass produce them? And that became his the standard hard shell taco.
Right.
Now, the question about whether it's appropriation or innovation, I'll leave that open. But I think Gustavo tells a pretty good story, or recovers an interesting story. But Taco Bell, of course, tells their own story on their website.
Right.
And they don't mention Meatla Cafe.
They don't mention it at all?
No, of course. Why would they?
Yeah. Interesting. So can you get down on a Crunchwrap Supreme, or is there like too much baggage there for you?
No, I mean, when I grew up, I'm from a very small town in Southern Arizona, less than 10,000 people. Wow. And when Taco Bell opened when I was in second grade, in the late 80s, my brother got a job right away. He was one of the first employees. And we were so excited because we had never been exposed to fast food Mexican food.
Right.
And to me, where I was at that stage, I was really in more reverence to KFC, at that time Kentucky Fried Chicken, and McDonald's and Burger King more than I was to even my own mother's cooking.
Right.
And that has a lot to say of the kind of internalized racism I had when I grew up, kind of dislike myself and my family. But when there was this fast Mexican food where you can even get like their equivalent of Happy Meals, that kind of made me feel sort of proud.
Yeah.
And it made me also realize that our food could be out there with everybody else's food. But as I got older, I came to realize a little bit more the complexities. And I also started turning more towards my family's food.
Yeah.
Because I started becoming a lot more proud of myself and my family
right.
and my roots through further education. So now I guess older me would still tell younger me, like, hey, you know what? Like Mexican pizza, do it. And now I probably still would say do it, but I would do it with a conscience.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Go ahead and eat it. Think about it.
Yeah.
So is that sort of the conclusion that your class reaches when you talk about it with them? Or are they, do you have like a debate or anything like that?
I think probably the greatest thing that the students take away is that they can look at food and they can put a face behind the food and realize food is one thing, but it's the stories of people and how we show care. And how we, you know, also how food is political. And to see that with our closest neighbor to the south that shares a long history of conquest, but also migration and just the shared knowledge of ideas and trade, it's really important because, especially when not just Mexican immigrants, but a lot of immigrants from Central America these days are being dehumanized, to put a human face also puts a human sense to what the urgency of this issue is. And when you bring about food, what could be more human than that?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you. And now I'm going to go into my rapid fire questions, which we gotta do this. All right. So should we say all-time favorite taco, or should we say top three? Which do you feel?
Ooh. Well, you know, actually, let's just do one.
Okay, let's do
You know what? I just got to pick one.
He's got one. Let's
you know, and it's funny because I got this question once, and I couldn't think. I was like, why do I got to pick one?
Right.
I just love them all. Just taco.
Yeah.
But then I remember I had this, probably one of my favorite tacos, and it's not easy to find here in New York City, but it was a taco with this kind of Sinaloan meat called chilorio.
Mm-hmm.
And my family, my father's family is from Sinaloa. So to find Sinaloan food in New York City was really tough. But anyway, this is a kind of a long braised beef, fried and then braised, and there's, I think, four different kinds of chili, and then topped on refried beans on a flour tortilla. Oh. So very different than some of the Poblano food, but also something that, because when I tasted it, reminded me of food I had growing up, and probably because the distance of the time, it really brought me back, and that experience was like really savoring, I guess.
Yeah. Did your mom make food that good when you were growing up?
Yeah, well, yes, kind of. I would say when I grew up, my family had five children, so at a certain point, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, mm-hmm. and that's when every day flour tortillas stacked up, tortillas with butter, all this great stuff, and then she started working, mm-hmm. and that's when we started buying more tortillas from the tortilla factory. Mm-hmm. But we had a good tortilla factory at home, too, but every day, though, always beans. Every day, always beans. Okay. Never miss.
Wait, so what's the name of the place where you get this taco? Can I go out and find it, like, as soon as this interview ends?
I think right now, they actually moved. It used to be called Taqueria Sinaloense, and now I believe it's called Las Delicias Mexicana, and it's in Corona.
Corona.
Yeah, near Queens. Junction Boulevard.
Okay.
And, actually, Robert Sietsema may be writing about it pretty soon, because he and I had some chilodio there about a week ago, and we were astounded.
Oh, man. Okay, yeah. So everyone get there first before Robert writes
about
it.
Yeah, right.
So what's your favorite taco type? If you had to pick, is it pastor? Or is it? What would you choose if you just had to only eat one type of taco for the rest of your life? I know that would be like a fate worse than death potentially.
Wow.
But.
You know, I guess because I had to think about that one again. I'm sort of conflicted because I'm a pretty classic carne asada, mm-hmm. Especially depending how it's grilled. Mm-hmm. But then also Al Pastor is kind of like my yardstick to know all right, is this place all right? But usually, probably if I had to pick one, I'm probably gonna go Al Pastor.
Al Pastor. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I said it.
I made him.
It's
say
on the
it.
Record.
He said it.
Oh boy.
Let's finish. Well, actually, I have two more. Okay, best U.S. city for tacos.
Ooh, wow. Well, you know, I think probably L.A. of course.
Yeah.
But there are some cities that are doing some really cool things. Mm-hmm. Tucson, Arizona, right now, they are an UNESCO World Heritage Culinary Site.
Yeah.
And that is really exciting because that's also Sonoran food, but it's also a border city.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's so much synergy there, including the Sonoran-style hot dog is one example.
Yes.
But there's so many great cities. You know, one city that's really interesting right now that I've been watching is Dallas. Dallas is doing some incredible, really great restaurants. Revolver Taco Lounge is probably one of my favorites. Regino Rojas did this really, speaking of Al Pastor, he did pulpo al pastor on a trompo. I've never seen anything like that.
Ooh.
I mean, these are octopus tentacles hanging off that you slice
amazing.
Into a tortilla. Yeah,
around,
wild. It looked like it was from outer space.
That's amazing.
People were taking their pictures with their kids next to it and things. But anyway, it was so delicious, and I never had that kind of slow-cooked, savory octopus, and it was delicious.
Oh my gosh.
So that kind of stuff is happening in Dallas, and I think Dallas is another place to really keep your eye on from mm-hmm. the taco scene.
Yeah, and you're a big proponent of New York too, even though New York, I feel like New York always gets this reputation as the tacos suck in New York, you can't go to New York for tacos, but you're here to differ, right?
Yeah, of course. I in fact, I wrote something for Eater that said, if you think that the tacos in New York suck, you need to go to Puebla, York. And
yeah.
I really say, if you really want to have the taco experience in New York City, you got to go to the outer boroughs. You got to go to Brooklyn. You got to go to Bronx. You got to go to Staten Island. And you definitely got to go to Queens.
Yeah.
And particularly Roosevelt Avenue and Corona. And you will, you'll be happy.
Yeah.
And, we got some tough representation, of course, with L.A., but I think we can hold our own here in Puebla, York.
Yeah, that's right. You can see you went out there with Rick the other day, so. If you check out that video, they made, I think Rick was sent to make tacos placeros, which are the giant tacos with the egg in them, like a whole chicken egg, right?
Indeed. Rick, I think he said these were the biggest tacos he's ever seen in his life.
Yeah.
So,
what would you compare them to size-wise? Because they can't see me holding out my hands.
It is
right
the size of a plate.
Yeah,
I mean, literally,
like
the tortilla,
plate,
the
like
tortilla
a
is a plate, and there is rice, and sometimes topped with the chile relleno and maybe a slice of pork.
Yeah.
I mean, these are a full meal in and of themselves.
It's like a one taco situation.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And I think, the way you can think of how the New York slice got bigger and bigger with competition, the taco placero was kind of going through this sort of similar experience right now.
Yeah. Okay. So tacos placero.
That's right.
Yeah. And then final question. Earliest taco memory.
Ooh. Well, actually, I can tell you the first time I ever tried a taco that came with the lime.
Oh.
And that, you know, as soon as you say that, you're like, well, tell me more.
Yes.
And
I
it was,
hear
I think it was the first time I ever saw a taco that came with the lime. I was an undergraduate at the University of Arizona, and I had grown up always with Tacos Dorados, where I was from.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my, and it was not necessarily just a Taco Bell taco, but it's also the style my mom would make.
Right.
So some buddies and I went to Nogales, Sonora, the nearest border town, and we had tacos on the street, and they were small flour tortillas with mesquite grilled carne asada. They came with the lime. And I'm like, what do I do with this? And it just squirted on top, and I didn't have anything else. And it was like this heavenly experience. And that's actually happened when I was a freshman in college. Then it became a thing, like, I need to find more of this closer in Tucson. And then I discovered Southside Tucson, Huero Canelos, BK's, and it just became like this taco renaissance where I was asking my mom a lot of questions about the food she made. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a kind of natural curiosity. Now that I think about it, I would have been the ideal student for taco literacy.
Where was that class?
Yeah.
We needed it.
Well, you know.
So your opinion on the lime on the taco? Someone once told me that, like, the lime on the taco, they were like, no, that's not authentic. People don't do the lime. And I was like, what? Is that?
Whoa.
Is that,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just delicious.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me.
And you had it in Mexico, right?
Yeah, it was on the border. And, you know, that place also, how would I put it, in Sonora, there's, it has its own culinary tradition, but especially grilled beef and flour tortillas are at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me to have that, it was sort of like the hallmark thing that Sonorans do. And my mom is Sonoran.
Yeah.
So this was something where I could also beginning to see that, no, this is good. I've been taught not to really like myself in this part of my background, but there's something here.
Yeah.
And it's something that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And, you know, tacos make you feel good, but when you know it's tacos are something that your people contributed to, I think, the wealth of mankind, humankind.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it makes you feel better about yourself. And that's actually something I do with a lot of the Mexican students I work, because I work with a lot of young folks in high schools and middle schools, too.
Mm-hmm.
And to really start thinking about how we value family, how we value care. And I think through food is one way we can see the kind of ancestry that passes on to us in those stories. I mean, we always had to think about, you know, times in our life that were special occasions. Food was somehow involved. But most importantly, the people who were sharing food with you were always going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is a way for folks to really start to see how this thing of Mexican food, for example, once it's decontextualized from the people, is very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, let's end on that note,
right.
I think. And I hope that you can check out our taco package where Stephen will bring you through all of the key moments of tacos in American history. And thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Manuel Gonzalez, and today I'm reading my essay, Tacos Are My Resistance. The morning after Donald Trump was elected president, I wrote out a list of things to prepare my kids for the coming storm. I included items such as how to fight with words, which rules are breakable, how to break them unnoticed, and how to be the kind of Mexican who people forget is Mexican at all. I realize now, 3 years later, that this list and how I conceived of it is flawed. Born out of a fear rather than indignation, a desire to hide from the world's events rather than resist them. If I were to write out a new list, it would be much different. And it would start with how to make tacos. After the climate strikes and local protests against Trump's Muslim bans and his draconian immigration policies, after shouting and marching in the streets of Lexington, Kentucky, and Williamstown, Massachusetts, cooking might seem like a weak form of resistance, or like no form at all. But as far as I'm concerned, teaching my kids how to cook, not just any food, but Mexican food, and not just any Mexican food, but the kind of slipshod Tex-Mex my mother made for me and my sister when we were kids, might be the strongest form of resistance I can give them. This food reminds them where they come from, who they are, and more importantly, to be proud of who they are. Because without this pride, resistance, the kind of sustained resistance we need now, is almost impossible to maintain. Maybe here you could formulate a metaphor, the ever-present taco, adaptable, crowd-pleasing, resilient, pliable, made with ingredients as simple as beans and rice, or as extravagant as scallops, or ribeye, or fried chicken and gravy, or Korean barbecue and kimchi. Fold a tortilla around practically any ingredient, and suddenly that combination becomes a taco. Maybe that's like Mexicans, too. Ever-present, adaptable, resilient. But if I told my kids this, they'd roll their eyes or stare blankly. They'd say, "You're being weird again, Dad." So instead, I've decided to teach them to cook. I'm not sure which night the lessons began. Maybe the one after Trump told Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to go home. She was born in New York. Maybe the one when we found out a sixth child died in custody at the border. It's hard to say. They all start to bleed together these nights. But on this night, we start simply. Ground beef tacos. The boy who is 9 is on stirring and pouring duty. Stir these beans on the stove. Pour the salt into the picante. The kitchen smells like my mother's. Mingling garlic and onions and comino. I give my son a wooden spoon and show him how to break up the ground beef sizzling in the skillet. The girl chops onions. I'm nervous when she grabs the knife. She's loosey-goosey with it, the way that gangly 13-year-olds are prone to be, but she doesn't slip. Perfect, I tell her as she slides them gently into the skillet to brown. Fresh into teenagerhood, my daughter is very aware of this strange political moment. When we lived in Kentucky, she stood up to the fifth-grade boys in her classroom practically every day. She argued against cruelty, against injustice. She argued for protecting the most vulnerable in society, immigrants, refugees, the poor. She argued so fiercely, the boys began scratching her name off of any list they found it on, whiteboards, class rosters, their way of trying to silence her, I suppose. It was a difficult year, but not once did she back down or silence herself when it came to what she believed was right. My son, though still in elementary school, is not far behind. But I worry that while my kids grasp the large-scale problems of this moment in our country's history and are willing to go to the mat for their beliefs, they don't understand the singular bearing this moment has on them specifically. I worry that they don't realize that what the president says about Mexicans, that we're rapists, drug dealers, and thugs, he's saying about them, too. I made a mistake 3 years ago, wanting my kids to be the kind of Mexicans people forget are Mexican. Being Mexicano is one of my favorite things about me, about us. Mexicanos are loving, caring, full of grit. We have a dark sense of humor, an ability to laugh and cry in the same breath. We know how to hustle. And the most Mexican thing about me is the food I cook, which is the same food my mother learned to cook from her mother. Teaching my kids to do this, too, is my way of telling them, look, people didn't want your great-grandmother here. And some of those same people didn't want your grandmother here. And some of those same people don't want us here either. But here we still are. This is our food. And we are still us. On this particular night, whichever night it was, the meat is cooked and ready. After chopping onions, our daughter made the guacamole and our son stirred some more. I did the rest. The kids' attention spans are limited, and they quickly got bored of the process, the waiting. But when we bring the food to the table, they both chime in, we helped. We sit and eat and laugh, and we talk about school and what we want to do this weekend. We talk about things that make us happy and safe. We talk about how good these tacos are. We don't talk about Trump. And that's resistance, too.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wertzman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me and maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.